Welcome to the Spoolcast. Ben Callahan joins Adam Churchill in this follow-up to his virtual seminar, Responsive Workflows, because there's no such thing as a perfect process. Ben didn't have time to answer all the questions during the seminar, so we decided to address those remaining questions in this podcast. If you didn't attend the seminar, don't worry, there's plenty here for you too. And now, here's Adam.
Everyone, welcome to the Spoolcast. A little while ago, Ben Callahan presented a great virtual seminar for us on responsive workflows. Now, there's over 175 UX seminars just like Ben's that are part of UIE's All You Can Learn if you want to get a hold of this presentation. So in today's podcast, Ben is coming back. He's joining us to discuss some of the great questions that were asked by our audience in that virtual seminar. In the seminar, Ben shares tips and techniques from giving and receiving design critiques to pitching ideas before they're fully baked to establish a responsive workflow that's focused on the end product. He shows how to bridge communication gaps, establish clear design goals, and build trust between management and project teams. Hey, Ben, thanks for spending a bit more time with us.
My pleasure, Adam. Thanks.
So for those that weren't with us for your presentation, can you give us a bit of an overview on what you presented that day?
Oh, yeah, of course. So I got a chance to talk with your listeners about just this idea of a more fluid process. And ironically, I kind of started the day off with a statement that I generally hate presentations on process. I wanted to start with that because I've seen a lot of them. You know, a lot of people talk about this stuff. And a lot of times we draw a lot of pretty pictures and, you know, beautiful little diagrams that illustrate it. But one thing that I've found is that we don't get into the details of what that actually looks like day to day. And not only that, you know, for those producing the work, but, you know, for those of us who have to manage a team, you know, what are the kinds of things we need to think about in terms of creating an environment where a more fluid process can exist? So that's kind of where I started and tried to quickly make the point that there is no one way, you know, there is no perfect process. I think that's just sort of a myth, you know, and I don't know why exactly that's such a strong belief, but everybody kind of, you know, they're looking for that one true way of how to do this work. And especially when you add the complexity of cross-device, you know, consistency and building stuff that works at any resolution on any device, when you add that level of complexity in, there's just so many factors that make it, you know, that kind of point us to the idea that there is no perfect way to do it. And so, you know, with those sort of foundational ideas, I tried to kind of guide us through a handful of just the kinds of things that we do. And so we've stopped focusing so much on deliverables, and we've started thinking about this idea that we need to sort of, you know, collaborate and iterate to the one deliverable that we do have in this whole deal, which is, you know, the thing that we're building. In the case of maybe a university, the deliverable for them might be a website, you know, a new public-facing site. In the case of some other organization, maybe it's some sort of a, you know, a web application behind authentication. Whatever it is, that is our deliverable. And we need to keep that in mind. And all that does is that keeps us focused on, you know, waiting to do our refinement until we've got something in the medium. And so I covered things like style comparisons and style prototypes and a little bit about element collages and just some of these ideas that are tools, you know, that we use early on in the process to try and get an understanding of how one of our clients, you know, brands might translate to the web. And as opposed to spending a week in Photoshop comping an idea, we can spend a few hours getting sort of a direction established, you know. And the same thing is true as it relates to content. And in parallel with that sort of thinking about style, we may be doing the same kind of thinking around content, prioritization of content and functionality on an individual page, but also in the system and also across all the different viewport widths that we have to support. You know, from there, I got into this idea where we just, another thing that's like we've seen really benefit our projects is giving our clients visibility into the dirty sort of underbelly of how things actually work. And so from the very beginning, you know, we invite them in to help us with our estimates. We do collaborative estimation, and we're trying to get a first step in the process taken in a real collaborative way. And then all the way through, we give them full access to everything that we're doing throughout. So they may very well will pull up, you know, a part of the project in the middle of the week somewhere that where things are broken, and that's okay. You know, they're going to see that brokenness and they may ask a few questions, but that's part of the process too. And we want them to see that. So we give them full visibility in. And then I kind of shared a little bit about what I'm really passionate about in terms of process, which is how we develop teams and how we develop individuals that are able to sort of take all these different varying factors in and, you know, come up with a good approach. So my idea here is that we can't come up with a perfect process. So instead, what we need is a bunch of tools that we can use. You know, when the problem presents itself, we know which tools to use, but then a shifting of our focus onto people instead of the process, so that we can focus on developing the people who are solving problems every day. And if we focus there, then we can sort of embrace this idea that maybe our team can improvise a little bit, you know, and when they find themselves in a situation where they haven't, you know, solved these problems, which honestly happens on almost every project that we're on these days, when they find themselves in that situation, they're smart enough, you know, to go and figure it out. So that's kind of the direction of the virtual seminar that I shared with you and your listeners.
Very cool. So you've sort of evolved this process over years of working with lots of organizations. What's happening when you present this to them? What are the concerns that they offer up, or maybe the challenges that they poke back at you with?
Ooh, that's good. You know, most commonly, I would say, I find that these ideas are significantly difficult for an organization that is structured in a way that's sort of in opposition to the process itself. And what I'm trying to say, that's a really complicated way of saying that I think we've structured our teams in organizations around sort of an old way of thinking, a very linear way of thinking. You know, I go into customers, meet with their teams often, and many times I'm sitting in a conference room, you know, maybe on site with a client where I've got two or three people from IT who are responsible for hosting the site and making sure that it's fast. I've got somebody from a marketing group or a PR side of the organization that's focused more on the content. And I've got somebody from a user experience group that cares about the design and, you know, the usability of the thing that we're building. And so we have these silos of individuals, right, spread out across all different locations and sometimes not even in the same buildings, right? Not even in the same countries occasionally. And this process that I kind of describe is much more collaborative. It requires all of those people to work together. We're a smart industry made up of really smart individuals. We can solve technical problems, but the stuff that's the most difficult and for me, some of the most interesting is figuring out how to get people to work together on this. So, you know, that's kind of why I wanted to share a little bit about, you know, how people learn and how it's a painful process to stay current. And a lot of those things are really relevant as it relates to organizational change as well.
So, Ben, one of the things our audience is always after is sort of the tools and resources that somebody like yourself and your entire team at Sparkbox uses. Talk to me about the tools that you're using to accomplish this. And one of the specific questions was about coding, but certainly I know a lot of what you have to offer is more of how you're communicating internally.
Sure, sure. So to address the coding question, you know, we've got a room full of folks who are very good at writing code. You know, we have a lot of front-end developers and a lot of back-end devs, and everybody kind of sits in the same space. In fact, our front-end developers probably could mostly be designers in another organization. You know, they're very, very good at design. They just happen to choose to use, you know, HTML and CSS and JavaScript as their tool for design. So in terms of coding for that group, we've got people who use Coda, which is an editor. You know, we've got people who use Sublime Text. We've got people who use Vim, and we use a lot of GitHub's resources. We're big fans of their whole software, of Git in general, but of GitHub's implementation. We do a lot in there. We track issues in there. We invite our clients into that issue tracking world with us. In terms of communication, you know, we use Slack, which is a slightly newer sort of real-time communication tool. The nice thing that we like about it is, well, there's a couple things. First of all, it's fully searchable. I gain sort of a full archive of the information exchange with our clients and, you know, internally here. So we invite our clients into that tool with us, and it's easily searchable and archivable. So all that stuff kind of stays with you, you know, for the duration of your project and even beyond if you so choose. The other thing that I really like about that tool is, I don't know that this is super intuitive, intentional on their part, but the way that it's structured any individual on my team who has, you know, full access to our organization there, so that's pretty much all of my team, they can see all of the channels that are available. So it's not like other sort of real-time communication tools where you have to be invited to participate in a conversation. In this situation, you get to choose what conversations you take part in. So what's interesting about that is that we have a lot of individuals who are just interested in other things that are happening on other projects. And so they'll be in those channels in Slack as well, and they can contribute because they have experience from other projects that's relevant, even though they aren't maybe necessarily specifically assigned to that job. So I love that sort of cross-pollination that that facilitates. It's really been interesting to see how that's, you know, impacted our projects. We also use more standard tools like Basecamp, you know, for project management, depending on if that's a need, you know, that level of PM kind of work is a need. We also are huge fans of Google's document stuff, you know, their spreadsheets, their documents. I guess a really good example of that is, I kind of hinted at this earlier, but we do this thing we call collaborative estimation. So if somebody reaches out to work with us, the first thing I do is get a rough understanding of their scope and put together a Google spreadsheet that I literally just share with them. And we call it collaborative estimation because I'm putting numbers in there and they get to see it and we get to work on that estimate together. We do the exact same thing with all of our other project updates as we go. So we have a content priority guide that's done in a Google Doc. And we do it that way so that our clients can get right in there and make changes and suggestions and comments. And that sort of real-time collaboration that those tools from Google provide is just amazing, and it's incredibly helpful. So we love those tools. There's probably a million others I'm forgetting, but those are the big ones, I suppose.
You know, just to follow up on that, what in particular do you use for making sure the entire team is looking at a timeline or deadlines? Are you using that Basecamp functionality with to-dos and things like that, or does that exist elsewhere?
Yeah, so we definitely, you know, sometimes use that. We sometimes use Basecamp. We also have, you know, sort of weekly, we encourage sort of a very, very regular cadence of conversation. You know, we do at least sort of a weekly meeting with our clients, and every week we're talking to them about the scope and their timeline. So that's a conversation that we have literally every week. And we also talk every week about budget. Most of the time it's just enough to say, hey, you know, we're on track. But what that means is that every week it's just an item we need to make sure we've covered. If we find ourselves just a little bit behind, we can say early in the process, hey, we're a little behind. We need to start prioritizing things. And that puts the decision for what gets done and what doesn't get done in the hands of our client, as opposed to us sort of pretending like we're right on track until the very end and then struggling to say, oh, we're not going to quite get everything done. So, you know, we want to invite them in to help us make good decisions for their project. So that's where we kind of talk about that stuff. We also, you know, have used Google Calendar for tracking that sort of thing, but Basecamp is good for that.
In the presentation, one of the things that you talked about, and I know it's just a piece of the puzzle, but it got a lot of traction in terms of the questions that were asked. You spoke of the content priority guide. Can you define that again and say a bit more about it?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, one thing that we noticed is as an organization, we're focused on, you know, we've really specialized on building stuff on the web. And what's interesting is most of our team, we have a creative director, a content strategist, a director of UX, a technology director, but everybody else, they just write code and work on the stuff that we're building all day long. So what's interesting is we have just sort of a little bit of a touch into all these other aspects like UX and content where we realize they're hugely important for the success of the kinds of work that we want to do. And so when we have an opportunity to work with a client who maybe from a budget perspective can't afford to bring in sort of a content, you know, strategy specialist, another organization that just does that, then we have enough, you know, people on our team that understand that we can work with them at sort of a introductory level. And one of the things that we've been doing there, and it really comes back to trying desperately to understand what the actual priority of everything that exists in their system is. And we call this a content priority guide. So it's part information architecture, part maybe simple content modeling, and maybe a little bit of sort of an audit of some kind, you know. And we do this in a Google Doc. I think Emily Gray, our content strategist, has written about this on our blog called The Foundry. So I could maybe somehow share a link with you on that, Adam. But it's a good tool for very, very quickly getting a sense of the unique types of pages that exist in a system and the types of content that exist on those pages. And because it's linear, it forces the conversation of priority. And so this sort of linear approach means that we're really forcing our client to say, this is the most important thing on a given page or in the system. And they're, again, in the Google Docs so that they can comment, so that they can move things around so they can ask questions and we can work on that together. So that's kind of the goal there.
What are some of the other ways that your team gets their head around or understands the priorities of the content?
So, you know, we use these content priority guides early in the process, but they don't include real content. They include, you know, sort of like that's kind of what I meant by hinting at sort of content modeling. You know, it's more about the kinds of content that exist. So we also do something called a content prototype, which is in HTML. We ask our content strategists or UX folks to write that markup. And, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking, you've heard the conversation for a while about if you're going to be a web designer, you need to learn to write some code, some CSS. You know, I believe if you're going to be someone who works in content on the web, you need to learn to write some HTML. And who better to make, you know, semantic decisions about the markup of the content than someone who fully understands that content? So we ask our UX and content strategy people to write those content prototypes. And then it includes real content. Obviously, we wouldn't do this for every page in a system. You know, there may be thousands of blog posts in a scenario. We'd pick one of those, right, and demonstrate. But the idea is that we start with that sort of purest model of semantic HTML with almost no style applied at all. And that means that we're focused on the content. We're focused on the priority. It's very linear because it's not laid out in any way. So that's one way. Another way would be, this is a little bit cheesy, but we actually do our wireframing at a really narrow width. And, you know, this kind of harkens back to Luke Rubluski's writings about mobile first, but this idea that we should be using small screens as an opportunity to kind of filter out a lot of the crap that we try to put on our websites. And if you're limited in real estate, you know, the viewport width and the height are small. If you're limited in the amount of space you have to present something, then you're really forced to prioritize. And I think that taking that approach from the very beginning, you know, when we start thinking about, you know, something that's more functional where we may use a wireframe, we want to do that small. We want to do it narrow so that we're really understanding the most difficult implementation case, you know, the absolute smallest screen we're going to build for. And then we find that it's much easier to sort of take an approach where that can grow and expand up into something that's, you know, much larger for a larger viewport width.
Very good. There were some questions. Obviously, people were thinking about business strategy and how this process that you were sort of teaching them to use, how they work that in. So how does an organization's business strategy or the structure of it tie in or maybe even conflict with this process for responsive workflows?
Yeah, that's good. Man, you know, I think in my mind, it's about looking for any efficiencies we can find in the way that we work. And if you talk to any, you know, business owner, they're going to be on board with that, right? If you can get the work done a little quicker, you know, if you can avoid, you know, spending a bunch of time traveling down a road that's just not the right path for their project, then they will be on board with that. So that's why we look for sort of very regular conversations with them. That's why we invite them in to help us make decisions along the way. Now, I really believe that, you know, and a lot of people in our industry get so frustrated with clients. They feel like, you know, clients are idiots. And I see these blog posts and even the entire Tumblr is kind of dedicated to ranting on clients. And what's amazing to me about this is that every project I've ever been a part of, the client has been the key to my success, you know? Like, they hold the knowledge that I need in order to be successful on this thing. They know the most of anybody about their business. And so, you know, we sort of take the opposite approach. You know, it's more about trying to understand what it is that they actually need and working with them to provide our expertise, you know, it's how to build this stuff on the web, how to make it accessible and how to adhere to the standards that are needed and how to build something that can work at any resolution. You know, the client realizes they need some of those things. That's why they brought you in. But you can't do it on your own. So I definitely think it's one of the best industries to work in, you know, web design, development, usability, because we get to learn so much about so many different businesses, you know. So I think for me, it's about really trying to understand what they actually need, you know, playing that level, that sort of translation layer, you know, where you kind of hear what they say, but understand what they actually mean. You know, that's a skill that will always be valuable. And I think for us, the way that we try to do that is by taking small steps in varying directions to make sure that our client's on board and turning the ship a little bit at a time, as opposed to going too far down the wrong path. So
with that in mind, there was sort of a question that came in through Twitter during the virtual seminar, and it asks, how do you deal with those clients that go way overboard with iterations? And actually, in some cases, when they have access to almost real-time development, Can you say a bit about that?
Yeah, this is good. Because, you know, I think this is actually probably one of the largest criticisms of this kind of approach. You know, inviting your client in means that they get to see your dirty laundry, right? And they may have a lot of ideas about the progress of the work that you've done when you haven't even really thought about the stuff that they're talking about yet. So this is good. But the idea that a client may actually, you know, I guess, I think you said go overboard, you know, with iterations, that's a real possibility. But honestly, this approach actually saves you more from that, right? So think about these two alternatives. One alternative is I do what I've just described, right? I do just a little bit of, maybe I do a style comparison, which is super simple, you know, 6-8 questions. You know, we show somebody other websites that are maybe dark and light, and we say, which one's right for you? Illustrated versus, you know, photographic, which one's right for you? And we start to gather really quick initial feedback from them. Well, I could do that, and then I could put together maybe a style tile of some kind, right? A static image that's just a handful of the design elements that we think are appropriate for them based on the feedback we got, put that together. Now, all told, I've probably only spent maybe a full day's worth of time, maybe 8 hours, say. The alternative to that is what we've done traditionally, which is from a UI standpoint, my designer disappears for a week. I come back with 30 to 40 hours build later, and I've got a homepage and a content page, and I present those to my client. Now, the alternative, right, these two sort of alternatives, if this is a client that has a lot of feedback and wants to have a say, they're going to be very involved in the small little decisions that you made, the style comparison and the style, and they may not like the style tile, but you've only spent 8 hours, right? If you get 30 or 40 hours in and then they only now get opportunity to give you feedback, you've wasted, you know, three times the amount of effort, maybe four times, maybe more, and you've got to go back to ground zero again, you know? So I feel like this actually helps. And a lot of times, I think those clients, they want a voice and they react like this occasionally, where they feel like maybe they're giving you too much feedback, but they're reacting to the fact that you're not giving them enough. And sometimes what we see is when we just invite them in and let them have a say, then they kind of back off and they feel like they're part of the conversation, like they're being heard. And so this honestly has never happened to us. Like this guy or gal is asking, you know, the idea that a client, because they're seeing every little iteration, they're going to go overboard asking for lots and lots more. Instead, it kind of quiets them, you know, and they get to see the progress and they feel like they're being heard. So I feel like it's actually a good sort of antidote to this challenge.
Cool. Well, Ben, this was great. Thanks for spending a bit more time with us.
Of course, my pleasure.
To our audience, thanks for listening in and for your support of the virtual seminar program and UIE's All You Can Learn. Goodbye for now.
You can access the recordings of all of our past virtual seminars as part of UIE's All You Can Learn. For more information, visit aycl.uie.com. That's aycl.uie.com. As always, thanks for listening.